Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to AMMO Art Chat. Tonight, we are going to be talking with writer, director, and artist George Gallo. And we'll get to George in a few minutes, but I wanted to say that this is our first of many Weekend with the Master interviews that we'll be doing, and we really look forward to this series. We'll be talking with a lot of great artists, also with a couple sponsors before the actual event, and then we'll be broadcasting live from San Diego in September. So to stay up on all of the interviews and everything, make sure you follow us on the page. If you look up at the right or left-hand corner, I believe it is, right underneath the AMMO logo, you can hit follow me and you'll be sent an email with all of the other interviews that get scheduled. So that's one way of staying up on this. I'm really, really looking forward to talking with George tonight. He has so many talents. His life experience is just amazing, and amidst all of that, he's been very successful writing. He's been a very successful director. His painting skills, we'll talk a little bit about that, and his philosophy are just amazing. And I have had a number of people come up to me and tell me just how humble and friendly and everything, down to earth George is, and all my conversations that I've had with him, I can honestly say that is so true. And of course, you know, I'm talking that he also directed Local Color, which is a wonderful movie, and we'll talk a little bit about that as well. There's a chat window that we have open, so if some of you would like to log in, or if all of you that are listening would like to log into the chat window, you're more than welcome to. You can post your questions there, and we'll try to get them online. And I also would like to introduce at this time my co-host, Blanche McAllister-Harris. Hello, Blanche.
Hey, Linda. Welcome, everybody. I'm calling you tonight from, pardon?
I was going to say, what have you been up to?
Well, I've just gotten back from the coast of North Carolina. I spent a few days down there taking one of my children to camp, and been doing a lot of painting, getting ready for my solo show that will be coming up, early next year. So I'm beginning to do some work on that.
Yeah, it's never too soon.
No, you don't want to wait till the last minute. I've been working on studies for it.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I can't wait to see all your work from that. That'll be really interesting. I know I'll be hopefully part of the process along the way, so
yeah.
Be able to see some of that work. One other note I wanted to pass along to everybody tonight. Our other co-host, Barbara Coleman, is now welcoming in her first grandchild. So she's up in Oregon at her daughter's place and enjoying Emma, and that's the new baby. So we want to send our congratulations out to Barbara. She won't be joining us tonight. Family is one of the most important things in life, and while we'll miss Barbara tonight on the show, we are just so happy for her and her family and all that is going on in her life right now. She will hopefully be back with us on June 12th, which will be our next interview with Weekend with the Master's instructor, C.W. Mundy, and that's June 12th at 7 p.m. Eastern. And then we have also another show coming up with Wayne Johnson, who's a friend of mine, and we'll be talking about the creative process, and that's on June 21st. So, but without any further delay, I want to bring in George Gallo. George has been painting since he was a child, and he was encouraged by his mother and an elementary teacher to continue his pursuits in painting. And he described key times in his life as fate playing a role. And we'll talk to George about that, some of those key times. And then you know, he was mentored by a number of people. We'll talk about that a little bit. And as I mentioned before, he's a writer and a director. He wrote and directed, and I guess you would say in a way, produced Local Color. And then George is a master artist, and he'll be providing instructions and workshops and demos at Weekend with the Masters in September. So, George, welcome.
Ed, thank you. Great to be a part of the show.
You know, we've been really looking forward to this. So let's jump right in. Okay, thank you. We're honored. So let's jump into the first topic that we want to talk about, which is local color. And, you know, we really want to talk to you about your art as well because of what you're going to be doing at Weekend with the Masters and your hopes and what you want to instill in your students there. But first we need to talk about local color because I'm sure a lot of artists have seen that and we would be remiss in not talking about that. Thank you so much for everything you did to make that movie. It was definitely a from the heart. It is near and dear to your heart. I told you before we came on the air that I read an interview that you had done where I found out in that interview that you actually mortgaged your house to make this movie.
Yeah, we sure did. And we get reminded every month that we mortgaged our home for it. So we're still trying to pay some of it off. I mean, but yeah, that's absolutely true. We did okay, you know, though. But specifically, what do you want to know about the film
One of the things that that struck me during the movie, and I saw the movie first before I started reading all of the other interviews and things like that, but it was just how strongly you feel about mentoring artists and passing along what you've learned to others, and that certainly comes out in the movie as one of the major themes. And then there's that whole disagreement about, or argument, if you will, about modernism or abstract painting versus representational art.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, look, to go back a little bit further, what you asked about mortgaging the house and everything, I mean, what happened was, and if you don't mind, then that'll sort of segue into the second question, but is
that's
that okay?
Fine. Oh, that's absolutely fine.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was, you know, I wrote the script. It was based on my, situation as a child. It was all very autobiographical. And, you know, at the time, in the 1970s especially, when I was 18 years old in 1974, you know, I went to various art schools to try to, you know, see if I could get into art school or college. And they were teaching a lot of modernism, you know. And, you know, I personally don't have I don't have a dislike for modernism as much as some of my, let's say, plein air friends do. I mean, some of it I find very interesting. Some of it I find to be quite annoying. You know, I've been told that it's the hiding place of the ungifted, you know. But, you know, I mean, some of it I think is very legitimate, you know. And if you follow art history, you know, which I do, I'm a real true art historian, it's all I really read, you know, you understand how, you know, it continued to get further and further out there and further, more and more experimental. I mean, I think the crime and the tragedy of it was that I think art critics began to embrace only that, and that anything that was representational suddenly became somehow hopelessly old-fashioned and completely not relevant. And my first question was, well, not relevant to whom? I mean, it was certainly moving me a great deal. And as much as there was something, let's say, very freeing about splattering paint or, you know, and trying to paint things that were going on, let's say, more in one's imagination or nervous system as opposed to what was going on before their eyes, you know, I just gravitated to wanting to move people because I was moved by certain kinds of painting, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's where I was at 18, and I couldn't find hardly an art school that had any interest in wanting to teach anything vaguely representational. Now it's gotten better, but it still is not. It's still not in the. I don't think it's representational painting. Sadly, I don't even like that. That phrase in a way, you know, but that type of painting, some form of realism, is not being taken seriously by art critics today. You know, I just think it's an absolute. I think it's a crime. I think it's very, very sad. And it's, I mean, look, I know the show's only an hour. I could babble for 20 straight hours about this, but you know, in order to answer the first question about the mortgaging the house, I couldn't find anyone that was interested in making the movie. And you know, we went to a lot of different studios, and nobody was particularly interested, and everyone said, eh, it's a movie about a kid that wants to be an artist, and nobody cares. And no matter how many people I tried to convince at the studios, and I've made a lot of studio pictures. I mean, you know the movies I've written. I wrote Midnight Run, Bad Boys. I wrote Wise Guys. I mean, I've done a lot of films. I've done like close to 20 movies. So, but I couldn't convince anybody of this. And I, you know, my wife was one of the producers on the film, Julie. And it was also in the film. And you know, we said to ourselves, look, we don't have kids. You know, let's make this our child. You know, as my dad once told me, he said, George, there's no such thing as a hearse with a luggage rack. So, you know, we don't have kids. So we said, all right, let's make this movie. You know, I mean, there are people out there who will appreciate this and who will get it. And it might be a niche market in the end, you know, but the people who have seen it absolutely, I mean, really, truly loved it. I mean, I still get letters I get a lot of letters from people that I ran into a woman a weekend with the Masters last year, and she said, you're Mr. Gallo. I said, yes. And she got choked up, and she started getting real tears in her eyes. She goes, thank you for making that movie. And I was like, well, my pleasure, really. And I mean that, you know, really with my heart and my hand. I mean, we did it just to do it. You know, we did it because we wanted to say something about art and mentorship and what it really means to, you know, have someone in your life that sort of takes you by the hand and helps you get to the place you need to go.
Now, there was an interesting scene. I used to watch Murphy Brown, and Eldon was, you know, trained in classical painting, and he would always paint these great murals on Murphy's ceilings and things like that. And she finally gets him into a gallery, and I think Yoko Ono was on the show too. And you know, he's in the gallery, and there's these drapes covering his ceiling that he painted, and all of the critics come in and they start going, oh, look, it's the exit sign. Oh, no, it's this little sign over here. No, it's a dot on the wall. Look, there's this hole over here. You know, and he just gets so disgusted and walked out. And it's kind of like, you know, and then at the end of it, the drape comes off the ceiling and falls over the critics. And they're like, oh, no, it's performance art or something. And it's still going on. And he just, like, throws his hat up in the air and walks away.
Yeah.
There are times when, and that's why I like that scene, when Serov is showing the
Nikolai Serov,
And, you know, and he's showing the pictures that the disabled kids painted and that he worked with, and, you know, and this guy's going. Yeah, I mean, that scene just reminded me of that scene from Murphy.
Well, that scene was based on a very real event that happened to me when I was a kid, and when I was 18 years old, and I was studying with George Cheropoff. George got pretty angry at some modern art exhibit that he was supposed to judge, and he gave the first prize to the air conditioner. So, I mean, that actually happened. I witnessed that with my own eyes. So, but that's what that scene was based on. He was not a big admirer of modern art. I mean, he would laugh at a lot of it, and I mean, again, I don't know how. I don't know what I can say or not say, but I don't know. I get, look.
Be yourself, George.
I'm sorry?
And be yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult. Look, I'm not talking about, look, I understand that people appreciate Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko and all of this, and I'm not putting any of these guys down because that's not what I'm about. Okay, they did what they did, and God love them for it. But when you start getting into things where people are dropping crucifixes into buckets of urine, you know, which, as you do know, was something that was paid for by the National Endowment of the Arts, when you start getting into that territory, to me, you're getting into something else now. And I think it's like it's anti-art and it's raging, and it's not about what I believe. I believe that art is supposed to uplift the souls of human beings. It's about it's about pointing the way to something better. And that's not to say that at times it's not meant to disturb. I'm not saying everything's supposed to be just all beautiful and backlit and wonderful and rosy, because that's not realistic either. But at the same time, it has to be done with some sense of, I think, wonderment and some sense of humility. And that other stuff to me is just, it's ego personified, and I don't think ego has any place in art whatsoever. I don't think it has any place in how one is supposed to look at a painting. I don't think you're supposed to come at a painting from any sense of judgment. I think you're supposed to come at it from a place of humility. That's how you look at it. That's how you let it into your heart. That's how you let it into your soul. It's almost like you have to remove yourself from the process in order to truly enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how you have to create at the same time. I think you have to, in some odd way, take yourself out of the equation. You have to serve something bigger than you. And because it's not about you. You just happen to be at a very specific time and place, and that you've been given certain gifts and skills, you know, and, you know, some people would call it God. You know, I happen to believe in some higher power that's out there. You know, I say my prayers at night. I believe they're being heard. That's just my personal beliefs. If, you know, if you don't believe that, fine, too. You know, I'm just talking about my personal belief system, and it helps me to create. It keeps me on track. It keeps me centered. It keeps me moral. You know, it keeps me, I mean, I'm far from perfect. You know, I'm not saying that. I don't want to get to like a holy roller conversation. I'm not talking about that. But I'm talking about just something bigger than you, something that you're coming from a humble place, because it's a gift to be able to share it, and I would not want to use whatever skills I've been given to depress people or to anger people or insult people. It just seems very unnecessary to me.
Right. I understand exactly what you're saying. So thank you for sharing that, too. Yeah,
okay.
I think that was put very, very well. So
one thing
I want to take us back to the second part of the question, which was your love for or how strongly you feel about mentoring. And can you tell us a little bit about who you were mentored by? And
I mean, it's very...
The film?
I'm sorry?
And how that influenced the film?
Well, influencing the film, I mean, yeah. I mean, look, it influenced me in general as a person. You know, I mean, the first person that really influenced me was my elementary school teacher, Frances Robinson, who was just a wonderful woman. I can still see her face. You know, and she just made it all so much fun. And I remember her taking out those big jars of tempera paint when we were kids, you know, the reds and the greens and the blues. And that's really where I felt the most comfortable as a kid, you know. That and English were the only things I really liked. I mean, mathematically, I am an idiot. I just, honest to God, if I play blackjack in Vegas, I get a 5 and a 7. I stare at it for a minute and a half, you know. So the math was definitely not my thing, you know. So yeah, that was very important, you know, mentorship. There was another, there was a teacher I had in high school, Bert Hughes, who was a music teacher, who was very influential. And you know, these people, they point the way in your life. They somehow make you feel okay about yourself, you know, because especially if you're an artist, you know, I mean, a real artist, you tend to be very sensitive, oversensitive in some ways. You kind of feel like a loner. You know, you can easily get led astray. You know, I felt very much like a loner and an outsider, and it didn't help that I was an only child, you know. So, you know, I was always spending lots of hours in my room drawing and painting pictures, you know. And then when I was 18, 19, I met George Charapov, and there was another guy, a guy who doesn't get enough credit. There was a guy that had a frame shop in my town named Aurelio Yamarino. What a great name for Italian immigrant, who was just a forgotten master. And he was a brilliant man and a brilliant painter. And he painted and he drew just for the sheer fun of it, you know. And he really should have been in some of the great more modernist museums in the world. I mean, I don't know what happened to his work, but he had these, I mean, just these amazing murals. He was always working on these projects, and he was a real artist. He was a real wonderful and generous and warm, crazy man, you know, just always working on these paintings, and he would finish them and shove them aside and then paint more paintings, and I don't know where any of them went, you know. who knows? But the guy really was a genius, and I don't use that word at all. And then George Cherepov was this wonderful representational painter, took me under his wing, and you know we went on a lot of painting trips together, and they help point the way. I don't know how to describe it other than that, and they give you that necessary pat on the head when you need it, and painting
is. But they don't let you get away with anything either.
Oh, no.
You know, it's not one of these, oh, George, this is wonderful. Keep it up. This stinks, George. Throw it away.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Cherepov can be a little rough on me. You know, he I mean, in the best sense of the word, I mean, he was very, when I met him, he was probably close to 80. So he didn't have a lot of patience, and he didn't suffer fools very much, you know. He'd pretty much seen it all and done it all, and he would give me a hard time. I mean, he'd say things like he'd look at my paintings and go, "Oh, I would kill myself if I painted this," you know. I mean, so yeah, he could be very funny. I take a slightly different approach, you know. I try to find the good in what everybody's doing, you know. I don't know if that's a good approach or a bad approach, but, look, it's very funny about painting. You know, I could draw very well when I was younger, but as in painting in oils, I was quite miserable until I was in probably into my late 20s. You know, every once in a while I would pull something off, but I didn't know why. And then certain things started to click in my head that got me to really learn how to paint, and I'll discuss that whatever you want me to, but it was an issue of how to see things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And one day it's sort of, you know. Anyway.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, George.
No, that's okay. I cut myself off because I just can't shut up, you know.
No, we're really enjoying this. And
okay.
Glenn, I heard you wanted to jump in with a question.
Yeah, I do, George. Well, this film is obviously a labor of love, and I read that you created all 400 paintings for the movie.
Yeah.
How many years did it take you to create this?
I did it in a couple of days. No, I'm joking. actually, those 400 paintings, and I don't know if that's the exact number or not, it was around 400 or 500 paintings. Those are basically the paintings that I had. I paint a lot, and I do a lot of plein air work. I'm always out there. I mean, on an average weekend, I'll do two or three, four, sometimes paintings. You know, I go out, I paint, throw it back in the car, drive to another location, you know, paint something else. And, you know, I could do two paintings on a Saturday, two on a Sunday, and I try to get some work done during the week in the studio. You know, I'll do larger paintings off some of the smaller studies, you know, but I tend to paint everything pretty big, pretty large. So those paintings that were in the film were a lot of the paintings that I had collected over time, you know, that I had, stashed away. And some I created specifically for the movie, but mostly that was just some of my inventory.
Oh,
yeah.
Did you market those as a series after the movie, or?
You know, I have to tell you, that would have been incredibly intelligent of me to do. But I where were you?
We've been here.
No, I didn't. I mean, I will at some point, maybe. You know, the disconnect. From my painting and my career as a painter is, if you can imagine this, you know, really what has been, I've sort of lived these two lives. You know, my true deep love besides my wife, okay, has been painting. And it's been so special to me that I've always had mixed emotions about putting it into the world, you know, because as a writer-director, in the film business, that's the stuff that I've been putting into the world, and that's what I've been earning my living at. And it's already hard enough to work 3 years on a movie you know, and because someone has asked me, what's it like to write and direct a movie? And I really mean this, okay? It's like, I think it's like running a marathon while getting pecked to death by chickens, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you finally get to the finish line, film critics take baseball bats and beat you to death. So it is very, and sometimes they're quite wonderful, but, you know, sometimes they're quite horrible. And, you know, I said in terms of my painting, I have to protect something of my soul because, I, you know, to put that on a wall and you know, have somebody come along and you know, not treat it the way you'd like it to be treated, I just didn't want to deal with it for a lot of years. You know, it was, and to be honest with you, I'm incredibly lucky as an artist because I don't have to earn a living at painting. I can wake up every morning and paint whatever the heck I want to paint because I'm doing it just for myself. You know, I mean, I know a lot of my friends who were painters. Like, I'm very dear friends with Alexi Steele and Jeremy Lipking and Tony Pro and David LaFell. And actually, you mentioned C.W. Mundy. I know real well. And Richard Schmidt, I know. I mean, these guys, they paint for a living. And if they sell, not all of them certainly, but if some of the guys that I mentioned, you know, if they start selling a certain type of painting, they might be prone to continue to produce that type of painting in order to live. And I get that. I mean, they have to feed themselves. But at the same time, I've been incredibly lucky to be exempt from that. You know, I can just wake up one morning and say, all right, I'm painting this. And then the next day I'm going to paint that. And, you know, and I don't have to worry about that. The only caveat is that I've now acquired possibly 1,500 canvases, some of them quite enormous, that I'm starting to not know where to put them anymore. David LaFell always comes by. You know, he lives in Taos. He's one of my dearest friends. And he comes over and just looks at my studio and just starts laughing and just says, oh, George, this is the biggest mess I've ever seen. And then I've got other friends that look at the work and they're like, George, what are you doing? You've got to put this stuff out there. And I'm like, yeah, I know, I'll get to it. I plan
Diego,
on getting
George.
To it. I'm sorry?
I said, we'll talk in San Diego.
You got it. I'm ready to talk away because it's literally like, I don't know if you're familiar with the Collier Brothers. Those are the guys that never left their house and they just collected junk for 50 years. I'm gonna die in an avalanche of my own panties if I don't watch that. So at some point we got
to
move them.
You're able to paint just for the love of it.
Yeah, really and truly, it's just been that special thing in my life, that special go-to thing that I know is always going to be there. And I've never, ever, ever gotten tired of it, you know. It's just been endlessly fascinating to me. And you never, you know, no matter how good you get, you know, I mean, I really work at it. I mean, I'm like, it's a muscle I'm always exercising. You know, no matter how good you get at it, there's still something you don't know. It's like, you know, there's still some other thing you want to get better at. And there's some, or you see something that really, really works, and it's like, oh, wow, I'm gonna play around with that idea, you know. And to me, it's just endless. Like, if I lived literally to be 1,000 years old, I'm certain it would fascinate me just as much, you know, every day. I just can't get enough of it. Yeah,
that's wonderful.
Yeah, we're envious as well. So,
are you?
Oh yeah, you know.
I just smell the tubes of paint. I swear to God, I open up the tubes and I'm like, oh, it's just like, oh, wow, fun, you know. I just,
You know, you don't want to be around me if I haven't picked up a paintbrush in a while, believe me. That's my little escape.
Wow.
Yeah, that does sort of make you grouchy when you can't get around to painting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I get quite depressed, you know, to be honest with you. That's why I try to fit in as much as possible. I mean, if I'm directing a film, then I don't. But I draw a lot, too. You know, just to keep that thing going, I'll try to draw, like, you know, caricatures of people working on the set, you know. And, you know, anyway, I'm just a, a doodler, I guess. I can't help
myself. But you're, you definitely have been bitten by the art bug, that's for sure. So,
you know, I
think
you,
all of us can.
Since I was a little kid, literally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since I was a little kid.
So how many weekends with the Masters have you done, and what are you hoping to instill in your students in those 4 or 5 days that you can have them and mold them and all that good stuff?
Well, this will be my fourth. So I think they've only done 4, and this is my fourth because I've had the first one.
So you've been there every year. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been there every year. And each year I've gotten more stuff to do. What do I want to instill in my students?
Mm-hmm.
So well,
if you walk away with one thing, what would you want that one thing to be?
I think that where most students go wrong, and this is part of what I want to teach, is that students have a tendency, and look, it all depends. Look, there are a lot of students that are pretty terrific too. You know that I've
mm-hmm.
The quality of some of the painters that come to work at Weekend with the Masters, I mean, are pretty top drawer. I'm always sort of stunned, you know. Because sometimes, look, there's all different levels there, don't get me wrong. But, you know, sometimes I walk around and I look at what people are doing and I'm like, holy cow, I mean, that's, you know, you should be teaching. You know, I mean,
well, that'd be quite a compliment. I mean, if you came around and said that to me, I would be, you know, very happy with that.
You know, I think that, look, the thing that people seem to mistake, the mistake that people make, it's not that I can't paint, I can't do rocks, I can't do faces, I can't do clouds, I can't do trees. People, and they think that there's some clever manipulation of a brush that they're just not getting, okay? Richard Schmidt says in his book, it's one of the most astute things I've ever heard. He said that you need more manual dexterity to sign your name than anything you'll probably ever use in oil painting. And he's very, very correct, because if you look at the great masterpieces, you know, there's nothing like what I would say is insanely difficult. It's the way you have to learn to not see things, but re-see things. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not telling you that you guys don't know, but it's like what people see, what students have a tendency to forget or not know, is that you have to learn, in order to create something realistically, in order to render something, let's say, realistically in paint, you have to at first break it down into the abstract in your mind and see it as a finished painting. Because can you imagine trying to direct a movie and you're not really sure the movie you're making? This will only lead to a disaster, okay? You have to know before you ever get to the set, before you start making the film, you know, because you're talking about day after day after day after day, you have to make up your mind that I'm making a specific kind of movie, I'm making a specific kind of story, these are the colors that I'm using to tell that story, and it is the same exact thing in painting. Guys, can I get a sip of water for a second?
Sure.
Hold on, just 1 second. Sorry about that. I just,
okay.
I'm not, like, leaving the room. It's right here. Okay. So if you're approaching a painting, you know, you have to look at your blank canvas, look at your subject, and you have to have a very clear picture from the start before you ever lay anything down at what you want this painting to be when you're done. That's not to say I'm going to have every last stroke figured out, because part of the fun of painting is the happy accidents and as it starts to come together, you get more and more inspired as you're working. But that can only occur if you know exactly what you're doing from the beginning. And the only, you know, I mean, the reason students tend to bungle paintings is because they don't have a clear picture before they start, you know. And if you think about that, should I keep going or should I stop? Am I just continue? Okay.
We want to hear everything.
Okay. When I look at something, let's say if I see something that really grabs me. All right. Well, I'm driving down the road or I'm anywhere. I see a bunch of trees, a beautiful group of trees, and I see this fiery bunch of leaves blowing in the wind, and there's a sky, a beautiful chroma to the sky, and I'm looking at this landscape, or let's say I'm doing that, and there's a broken down stone wall, and there's these wonderful waves of grass. The first thing I say to myself, what am I feeling here? What is this saying to me? Okay, it's joy, it's happy, it's upbeat, it's, you know, it's like as close to God as you're going to get. It's got all these wonderful elements to it. Okay, how do I say this? Okay, I start breaking it down. Okay, these are shapes, these are colors, there's a kind of energy going on here, and I start asking myself a series of questions before I ever put a brush down. You know, what's the predominant color? Is it warms? Is it cools? You know, what are the complementary colors? Because, you know, basically all impressionism is based on the interaction of your three secondary colors, purple, green, orange. I work all this stuff out in advance. If there's a lot of green in a painting, which can always get tricky, especially when you're painting in the summer or in the spring, where are the complementary colors? Where are the reds? Where are the pinks? You know, where are the purples? Because green can be a rough color if you don't watch it. And what is my predominant subject? What is my sharpest value? What is my lightest light? What is my darkest dark? I have to work that stuff out. Now, obviously, if you paint a lot, you can work those things out in your head in about 30 seconds. You really do. You just look and you go, this is this, this is that, this is this. This is my center of interest. This is where I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to hold your eye here. I'm going to make your eye dance around the canvas over here. Because really what you're trying to do is you're taking a rectangle or a square and you're trying to hold the viewer's eye as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is about design. I think design is probably the most important thing in any canvas. I've heard people say otherwise. I don't buy it. It's because, and I'll tell you why, because you can have a miserably painted painting, okay? But if the design is good, you tend to keep looking at it. You know, even if the values are off and the colors are horrible, there's something about something that's well-placed inside that space that tends to keep you looking at it. And the opposite of that is I've seen beautifully rendered paintings with wonderful values and colors that were poorly designed, you know, and for some reason they won't hold your interest. They just won't, because there's not those primary elements to hold you, you know.
Right.
So I work all of that stuff out in advance before I paint, and then I go to work. And that's what I want to impart upon students, is that this is not as hard as you think it is. It's just that you're not thinking straight, and you're not looking at your subject the way an artist looks at their subject. A student looks at that and says, oh, I can't do mountains. And I go, but that's not a mountain. You're never going to be able to paint a mountain, all right? I can't paint a mountain. The greatest painters that ever lived don't paint mountains. They look at something and they go, that's a shape. Okay, what color is that shape? What value is that shape? On a scale of 1 to 9, what value is it? Let's say if it were black, like we were looking at it in black and white. Okay, it's about a 4. Oh, you can do that, can't you? Okay, how sharp is that edge against the sky? Okay, is it warm? Is it cool? Oh, it's sort of cool. It's sort of purple. It's a value of 4. Aha! That's not so hard. Give me that brush. Boom, 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 boom. There's your mountain. Moving on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people, it's trying to get the students to understand it. And once they do, I mean, I've seen students just light up, you know, and they go, well, I can't paint an orange. Well, Nick, I can't paint an orange either. I can't paint an apple. I can paint a shape. I can paint something that's warmer over here or cooler over there, that's got a hard edge over here, a soft edge over there. I mean, it's just seeing things now in the abstract, seeing them as paint in advance. I hope that's clear, but it's seeing the thing as a painting in advance, and that's that. Once you're able to do that, you know, once you're able to trust that, you'll start painting good paintings pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Being like an artist. George, your workshops at Weekend with the Masters are indoors. focusing on some of the technical aspects of painting.
Yes,
Go ahead.
Say that again, sorry. I'm so sorry, I didn't hear you.
I was going to say, one demonstration is about a la prima painting on a large canvas. Are you going to be working from studies or photo reference?
I'll probably be working from studies. You know, I originally wanted to do these classes outdoors, but part of the reason was, because of the weekend with the master's program, there are very, very specific times. Like, it's got to be from, let's say, a class starts at 9 and goes till noon. And if the weather is bad, I wouldn't be able to do a plein air, a big plein air painting, or I wouldn't be able to teach in the way that I wanted to. Now, I thought that, well, I don't want people out there standing in the rain, and if it's a rotten day and it's gray, I didn't want students paying for a lesson where, they're going to do these horrible gray paintings, So I figured, if we could at least, because we're working a very specific time, let's say, 9 in the morning till noon, and then it goes sometimes there's a lunch break and we go further after lunch until 4 or 5 o'clock. I thought if they could bring studies or very good photos, which I generally think is not a great way to paint, unless you paint outdoors a lot, which I do, you could work off a photo. But if you have a study you like, or let's say a study and a photo, what I'm trying to do is I don't want to take a bunch of students outdoors, which sometimes you end up doing this in workshops. You take a bunch of students outdoors, everybody goes down to the beach, everybody drops their easel, and everybody starts noodling away, and you go from person to person, go, yeah, that's nice, sharpen that, and that's nice, and cool that off. And they don't really learn anything from that to me. I mean, they walk away maybe thinking they did a few nice paintings, but I think if in an environment like this, inside of a classroom, where they're painting and I'm really, really focusing on what they're doing, they can walk away really much better artists than they did when they got there, if that's what they're really out to do. And I could really focus on what everybody's doing and really get them to think, because, painting is, it's the most fun thing you can do in the world, but it is also work. And I'm sure Rembrandt and Van Gogh, he shot himself. He was so wound up, okay? It's hard work. It should be the most fun you ever have, working your tail off. But you've got to learn the language. And once you learn the language, communication is much easier. But I am shocked at how many people don't know the language. And then they say, well, I keep getting into trouble. I'm like, you're getting into trouble because you're making the same mistake over and over again. And no one's taught you to not do that mistake, you don't know why you're making that mistake. I make mistakes all the time, and there's not a painter in the world who doesn't. But the second I see something going wrong, I know exactly how to get out of it, because I've got a checklist of things I start asking myself. Is my color temperature off? Is my design off? Are these edges wrong? It's got to be one of those things. It has to be one of those things. It can't be, I don't have any fire today. That's kind of nonsense. That's like blaming other things. There's generally when things start to go awry, there's a technical problem that's making you go awry, and then you can get back to being inspired again once you alleviate that problem.
Well, that's a great idea. Doing it inside, and then you're not battling the elements while you're trying to learn.
Yeah, because again, look, I would love to teach a plein air course outdoors, but I don't think you could do it properly in a day and expect people to walk away getting much out of it other than they had fun in the sun. If you really, truly want to get better, I think this is a great environment to do it. And I know that I can really, really help students because, I have truly, as an artist, I've made every mistake there is to make, And I say that, with a lot of bravado, you know, because I'm happy I made all those mistakes because they made me better, you know, because I worked through them all, you know, and not all of them. I'm sure there's still a million ahead of me, you know, but at least I've cured enough of them that I think I can help a great deal.
Mm-hmm. I know you paint large paintings a lot of the time. How large of a canvas are you going to be painting for maybe your Hall of
Fame? Demo? For the demo, I'll probably do a 40-50.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Or a 50. Yeah, I mean, I paint a lot. You know, the school that I most admire in landscape painting is, which now will get me into a whole other subject, if you don't mind. The school of landscape painting that I most admire, well, basically it started at the Art Students League with Robert Henri and the whole Ashcan school, and, you know, George Wesley Bellows, who I think is probably one of the five greatest painters that America ever produced, you know, and all of those guys, and there was Glackens and all of those guys that came out of that whole school. And in particular, there were a few painters who were a part of that group that then moved to Pennsylvania. One of them was Edward Redfield, and he was all part of that Henry crew. And Redfield, for me, is like one of the great American landscape painters of all time. Him and another painter, Daniel Garber, and they were part of what is certainly called the Pennsylvania School of Impressionism. They all painted in the New Hope area, and Redfield would paint canvases as large as 50 by 56 outdoors, and it took him 10 years to figure out how to do it. But he started to get into a very brilliant, wonderful, fascinating, energetic kind of shorthand to render what he was seeing. And I have to tell you, the first time I saw a Redfield painting, I almost started to cry. I was about 18 years old, 17 years old, at Grand Central Art Galleries in New York City, and I saw one of those paintings on the wall, and the energy was just pouring out of it because you could see there was a guy racing against time, trying to capture what he saw in front of him. And he wasn't even all that concerned about getting, this is where you get into a funny area, but and I'll explain it. He wasn't that concerned with, let's say, getting the drawing absolutely perfect as much as he was trying to express the color, shapes, and values of what he saw in front of him. Because some of the drawing, if you want to get, let's say, overly technical, might be considered, it certainly wasn't as fine as, let's say, an Andrew Wyeth or something like that, you know. But there's so much energy and so much going on in this work. And the guy could draw as well as anybody. Don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating bad skills at all. I'm just saying it wasn't, I think there's actually an over preoccupation with a lot of artists, say they're just drawing too damn much. And what I mean by that is they've forgotten how to paint. And it's almost like, and there is a difference between drawing and painting, because drawing is about line and painting is about mass. And there's a much different approach because there are no lines. You know, lines are something the man has invented in order to show the edge of one thing meeting another thing, but that's not really what's going on. It's all shape, mass, form, you know, things in space. And painting can get you closer to that. But there's too many guys, just for my taste, showing off how good they are. Oh, I can draw better. No, I can draw better. I can draw better. If you look at the true great masterpieces, I mean the great ones, you look at Winslow Homer, and I'll mention Redfield and George Wesley Bellows, and you look at the French Impressionists, there's nothing in any of those paintings where you go, wow, did you see the drawing in that painting? I mean, this is more of a preoccupation as of late. And I think it actually gets in the way of good painting. It's just my personal opinion. But it doesn't, you start getting into, to me it's like you start getting into a different place, which sort of gets us back to the beginning of the conversation, which is you're now getting back into ego, you know, because it starts to become about something else. It starts becoming like, look at me as opposed to look at this. And if you're talking about look at this, look at how beautiful this day was, again, you got to take yourself a little bit out of the equation. It's like, all right, I know you can draw. I got it already, okay? I got it. It's like, that's not what I'm here to see. I'm here to see your soul, you know, not, you know, what your skills are, you know, in, to the point where you're showing off. I'll give you another example. I was in New Orleans years ago. I was making a movie, and we're down there visiting a blues club, and there was a guy on stage with an alto sax. I play saxophone a little bit, too. And the guy was technically like this amazing sax player. I mean, he's all over the place, you know. And we were like, wow, that guy's a technical genius. And then we were walking back to the hotel, and we're walking down this alley, and there's like this old black guy playing in the alley. He had a tenor sax, he had a hat on, and he's playing just a couple of notes. And these notes were bouncing off the walls of the alley and up through the fire escapes. And I'm telling you, with a couple of notes, that guy said more than that guy that we paid a lot of money to see in the club. And it really goes to show you how little you really need if you're telling the truth, you know? And mm-hmm. all the other, you need a lot of nonsense to dazzle somebody if there's not a lot of truth, you know? You just need lots and lots of dazzle and lots of nonsense and a lot of highlights and a lot of just gibberish in order to get someone, but and it can almost work. But, you know, in the end, I think you look at the painting and you go, yeah, that's some feat. You know, that's something that person pulled off. That's cool. But it's not necessarily something that grabs your heart and massages your soul and brings tears to your eyes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, did I use the hour up yet?
Well, actually, you know,
we've got more.
We've got 38 minutes left. I scheduled us for 90 minutes, George. So
oh,
we
did
have
you?
Plenty of time. Yes, I did.
Oh, I could go forever.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're only 90 minutes.
Day 7 of George Gallo and Weekend with the Masters.
one of the things, staying in what you were talking about, design and things like that. Both Blanche and I have studied with a year with Kevin on our AMMO program called Protégé. And Kevin would break down into 11 different
Who's Kevin?
Lessons. Kevin McPherson.
Oh, I know Kevin. Okay, great. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah,
I got one of his paintings here.
Oh, cool. I do.
All right.
So, anyway, Kevin took 11 lessons and broke a lot of the different concepts down in the Protégé program. And it really helps because it does break it down. You're concentrating on this one thing for this one lesson. It makes it easier for you to start seeing things differently. One of the things that happened is that I traveled to New Zealand, beautiful country, went down to Queenstown, and I was watching a master down there paint by the name of Ben Ho, and he came out and painted a 16 by 20 in 45 minutes. And it was interesting because most of the other painters, I didn't paint. I just observed Ben painting. One of the things that I thought was interesting is in about, I would say, 30 seconds to a minute, he had his whole painting in his head, drew the planes out on the canvas, and then painted. I mean, if you looked at the planes that he had, it wasn't a drawing, and I started thinking about that in my process, and I would draw this thing out, meticulously draw things out, and then I'd sit there and paint by number. And this little spot here goes green. So then it started getting me thinking, watching him paint this is, you know, he's just painting shapes of colors within those planes.
Right.
So he broke the planes down into, you know, shapes, and then shapes of color inside there, and then maybe even inside that shape of color, there was another shape of color.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an interesting aha moment for me. So, and I think there, you know, without having that study time with Kevin, and Kevin is a mentor in this program, so, you know, without having that time to really get that aha, I'm not sure I would have. And I'm just curious, was this an aha moment for you when you started seeing shapes, or did you always see that way?
No, I when I was a kid, I was very good at ripping off other painters. It's really funny. You know, I could, like, I had some sort of weird sixth sense that, you know, when I was like, 15, 14 years old, we had a Robert Wood print in the house, the painter Robert Wood. And I used to take that painting off the wall and bring it upstairs and try to copy it, you know. I was pretty good at, let's say, aping things, but I could not look at something outdoors, you know, like a field or a mountain or a creek or whatever, and figure out how to render it on my own. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I've had a series of aha moments. I think I still have them, you know, quite often. But, yeah, I mean, to ask your question about shapes, it took a long time, you know. I'm still, you know, it's funny because I don't really meticulously draw very much at all. Sometimes I'll do planes. Sometimes I'll start with some lines, you know. If I'm working on a larger canvas, sometimes I'll start with lines just because, you know, where the placement of things are is very, very important. If there's a piece of architecture, let's say, in the painting, like a lot of it is a lot of abstract, trees and clouds, and because that stuff tends to move a lot, you know, and that's something that I think people also forget when they're painting a landscape, is that everything is constantly in motion. Even still,
right.
Water is moving, you know, clouds are moving, you know, everything has got, trees are waving in the breeze, you know, grass is moving, water's moving, you know. The only thing that will probably hold still is architecture. You know, if there's like a house in the distance, might have a sharper edge. So I might start out by placing that with a, you know, like a rigger brush, you know, like just draw a couple lines or something to try to suggest where I'm going to place the house or, you know, maybe a couple of edges of the creek just to get an idea of what it is. I don't follow any hard and fast rules. A lot of times, it's how I feel on the day. But in general, yes, you have to see everything as these big shapes and things going on inside of these other shapes and planes, as you put it, which is a good word. It's like it's planes of things catching light, you know.
Right.
And you know, I do a lot of squinting, too, in landscapes and try to, because, you know, the eye gets hungry and greedy, you know, and you look at something outdoors, especially if you're painting it and you want to render it. Sometimes you go like, oh, I'm going to, if you don't watch out, you'll end up throwing everything but the kitchen sink in the painting, and you'll completely forget why you started it in the first place. The entire act of painting is a very unnatural act, and what I mean by that is you don't generally sit and stare at something for two straight hours.
Right.
You know, you look at something and you may let it in and go, wow, this is just gorgeous, this is breathtaking. But if you look at it 4 or 5 minutes, that's already a lot, you know. Painting, you'll stand there a long time and you'll start overanalyzing everything. And I try to always go back to what initially made me interested in this subject, because that's the thing you're really looking for. It's that first wham, you know, that you got when you looked at it. And then, you know, you broke it down into the various elements in order to paint it, but you got to get back to wham, because if you don't watch out, you know, here's another thing that happens is, as artists, this is what I try to tell students, you got to make up your mind what really is the important thing to you in the painting. Is it the sky? Is it this? Is it that? Because if you don't watch out, you'll start looking, you know, your iris changes. When you start looking into the shadows, you'll start seeing all kinds of detail into the shadows that aren't there when you're looking into the lighter elements of the same frame of view. So you can't paint both. It's like you got to make up your mind. You know, it's like, you know, there might be a few little delicious hits in the darkness, you know, but if you don't watch out, you'll start painting this sort of schizophrenic painting where everything is of importance, and then you don't have anything, you know. So you have to figure out your light and dark pattern very quickly, too. Did you ask me something about the, does that answer the question? I hope it does.
Yeah. it was very interesting when I was watching Ben Ho paint, because being a beginner in this whole process, it was, I would go up to a scene and I'd find the area that I wanted to be, and I would paint everything exactly like it. It was almost like I was the encyclopedia person, you know. I was going to get every detail in that one place, you know, in my painting. And I stood there and watched Ben, and sometimes observation is just, you know, you learn so much more than trying to do it yourself. And Ben looked to his left, scanned all the way over to his right, went back, looked to his left, pulled an element from his left that he liked, something from the center, something from the right, and designed his painting. And, it, you know, I'm standing there looking at this thing going, that doesn't look like where I'm standing. What are you doing?
Wow.
You know? But at the same token, it was a beautiful painting. And
that is an amazing lesson you got. That is an amazing lesson you got. I have to tell you, because a lot of times, because Ben is his name, right?
Ben
knew what he wanted his painting to be before he started, you know. And he knew also that sometimes you got to grab an element from off your visual field in order to create a successful painting. You know, this is another mistake that a lot of people make. In fact, if you read, I got this great book about 4 or 5 months ago on Edward Redfield, and it was a bunch of letters he'd written to other painters, you know. And it's great reading a letter that this insanely gifted painter wrote to another painter. And he was talking about how it is, he goes, after 20 years of painting outdoors, I've come to the conclusion that it's impossible to paint exactly what is in front of me. You know,
so true.
And he says, I caught some hell, if I could say that word. He caught some hell from the whatever the local people were. He painted a painting of New Hope. He said, and I moved the bridge in the painting.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, the bridge is not there. And he goes, yeah, but if I put the bridge there, it wouldn't look good in the painting. If I put the bridge where it was, you know. And he goes, the bridge looks fine where it is in real life, but in a painting, it's just not a great painting. You know, so you have to have the foresight to know, you know, what's going to look good and what's not going to look good. And, you know, I'll tell you something else that I found interesting, which maybe the listeners will find interesting. You know, I'm a bit of a pack rat in terms of my artwork. I tend to keep everything. And sometimes, you know, for giggles, you know, I have a couple of painter friends come over, like Tony Pro or Alexi or whoever, and we start pulling out old paintings that I did 30 years ago, and we start cracking up, you know, like how awful some of them are. But at the same time, it's funny how I look at them now, and as awful as they are, it's funny how I wasn't off by much. I don't know if that makes any sense at all. It's like, you know, like we'll look at them and I say, you know, now it took me 30 years to get to where I'm at, now 40 years, you know. But if I had 10 more minutes on that painting, I could turn it around, you know, because I can identify what I was doing wrong. Like the sky is too warm or the sky is too cool. You know, if I just change the color of the sky and I sharpen a couple of edges, that would be a decent painting, you know, but I didn't know and I didn't have the knowledge. But the thing about a lot of students is they don't realize how close they really are sometimes. Like I'll have students in a class and, you know, this one woman in particular, I can't remember her name, really sweet lady, she's going, oh, I'm making such a mess. And I said, hon, you don't know how close you are. And she looked at me like I was crazy. You're just being nice. I said, no, I'm not being nice. And I said, can I take your brush for a second? And she said, yeah. I said, look, I always hated when my teachers took their brush and worked on my paintings. I hated it, okay? But the fact is I was there to learn. You know, I'm glad. In retrospect, you know, it was just my ego as a young man, you know, like, don't touch my masterpiece, you know. And I said, look, if you add a little bit over here and you put a little bit over here and put a highlight over here and this shadow's to cool this off. And she was like, oh, my God, you know, Mr. Cow, I said, well, I said, honey, that took me, what, 35 seconds? You did all the heavy lifting. you don't know how close you were. And it's just, that's what I'm going to try to get students to see in the class, you know. So.
That would be so encouraging to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the truth, too. It really is the truth. It's and the other thing I want to get people to understand, which is sort of like we're coming full circle in a way, is you make all your mistakes in the beginning. You know, it's not like you only get lost in the middle because you screwed up in the beginning. It's not like you had this great start and suddenly you got lost. Believe me, if you got a great start, you should at least have a good finish. You can screw it up somewhere down the line. You always can. You know, you get a little carried away. You put too many branches in it. You get a little cute. You add too many leaves, whatever it is. But in general, if you've got a great start, you should be able to land okay. Or if not, at least recover. You know, this is why I'm telling you, I say this to students too all the time, like, don't feel like, I got to get to the heavy paint. Look, that palette isn't going anywhere, okay? Just take a breath, you know, and just really, really think about what you're doing from the beginning, because you'll have less and less problems, and you'll work much quicker as you get through it towards the end. So.
Yeah. George, in your workshop about brush stroke,
yes.
In the description, you said that brush strokes are the words of the artist?
The words.
Yeah. When I think about brush work, I'm not so sure I can provide actual names to that. Maybe it's because I'm thinking more about the effect a certain stroke has or what kind of line it produces or how strokes in a certain direction provide the viewer with certain understandings. Can you provide us some examples of brushwork and what they might be conveying?
Well, you know, like, for instance, there's certain painters that I would reference. You know, there's certain painters that smooth everything out like glass, you know, and I guess that's okay. I'm, as you could tell from my work, I'm not one of those guys at all. You know, I'm sort of sometimes I feel like I could throw it on with a pitchfork. You know, I get really excited when I'm working and I'm trying to, I love manipulating oil paint, you know, to get it to say things. I think what is fun about oil painting and brush strokes in general is that you can get a kind of a symphony going of just paint, you know, that certain things are flat, certain things have a choppy kind of feel, other things have a flowing sort of feel, and you can just describe it with the kind of excitement where you're almost, you know, to just cut loose. I mean, again, I don't mean to reference Edward Redfield so much, but this was a guy who really was not afraid of paint. And, you know, you could feel all the joy he was having, you know, like with horizontal strokes, let's say, you know, to describe tree bark. And he'd go across, whoop, 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 whoops, across, and then, you know, break it up a little bit and then a couple of dots and dashes, and then, you know, vertical strokes, you know, for the stalk towards the bottom. And then, you know, he would get excited about the grass, and you could just feel him going, boom, 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 doing all the strokes, and it just, there's a kind of energy in that work, you know. I know some painters say that water should be handled simply. You know, I don't buy any of this nonsense. I mean, if you look at Redfield's work, he just chopped away at the water, and he got the energy in it, you know, he didn't keep flattening the paint. He would just scoop it and hit it with a couple of strokes and scoop it up and hit it with a couple of strokes. I think it's a bit of a – look, there's some wonderful painters out there that are really painting, you know, really using paint. And I think that's one of the most exciting things about oils, you know, is that you really get to mold things and move things around. And that's sort of what I mean about, like, you would certainly describe a bunch of sharp rocks much differently than a meadow, you know, you know, long grass swaying in the breeze, you know, with dappled sunlight. You know, you would certainly describe that differently than you would water rushing over rocks. I mean, the first thing I would ask you is, well, what does that meadow make you feel like? I mean, does it make you feel nervous? Does it make you feel centered? You know, look at the edges, you know, where the meadow reaches the woods. You know, I mean, is that a soft edge? Is that a hard edge? Well, most people would tell you that's a soft edge. Okay, and isn't there something like a wonderful sort of romantic, you know, undulating quality that's going on in that meadow? Yes. Okay, well, how would you describe that? Well, I guess I would use this brush. You know, well, now you're thinking, okay, you know, use that nice soft brush there and just start feeling it, you know, just start feeling it. I mean, it's, look, it only looks like magic in the end when you do it right. I mean, the process is, you know, it's not, you know, you're finding a color, you're finding a value, you're laying it down with a kind of, you know, your human feelings that you have of the things that you're seeing in front of you, and you're expressing it, you know, I mean, it's the same thing in music, you know, allegro, pizzicato, they're all different ways to attack your instrument. You know, it's the same thing in painting, and only you're using brushes and palette knives and painting knives and paint, and it's just learning it, being fearless about the medium. So a lot of times I'll look at a sky and it's always you know, there's a lot of different things going on in even a blue sky. I mean, a blue sky is not really that blue if you really look at it closely. There's a lot of warms going on in it. There's a lot, you know, especially when you mentioned Ben, it's very funny. You said you look to the left, you look to the right. I'm always looking to the left and to the right because, you know, the sun is generally not in the painting, but I want to know, obviously, first and foremost, where is the sun, because that's where my shadows are going. And then I also know that the sky is going to behave much differently, you know, in terms of color, where it is in relation to the sun. Because in generally, if the sun is on the right side of your painting, let's say, the sky is going to cool as it goes across the canvas. I'm always shocked at how many people don't think of that. And I'm like, what are you kidding? I mean, the closer you get to the sun, the warmer the sky is going to get. The more it's going to pick up, it's going to start picking up those warmer tones. So a lot of times, I first thing I do is figure out, well, obviously the sun's to the right of this painting, so I'm going to just gradually cool it as I go right to left, you know. Those aren't really tricks. I mean, that's just looking at nature for a long time, you know. And my wife has always given me a hard time because she says, when we're driving in the car, I'm not paying attention. You know, she goes, stop looking at that hillside, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I bet she drives a lot.
Huh?
I said, I bet she drives more than you do.
Yeah, she does, or she keeps an eye on me, you know. But because I could just get lost and rear-end somebody, you know. But but thank God I haven't yet. I'm 56, so I think I probably beat that one already. But my wife's not a painter, but she has got an amazing eye. I mean, she gets so moved by this stuff, you know. So, which is great, because I think it'd be pretty hard to have a spouse, you know, who walked into the room or saw your painting and went, that's nice, you know, or whatever. You know, I mean, she really...
Yeah.
And she's got a great eye. She always... I'll tell you, sometimes I want to kill her, but she really knows when something's wrong, you know. She'll tell me, she goes, what's that thing over there? And I'm like, oh, like I want to just go nuts, you know. But she's right. She'll catch it right away. She catches values very quickly, too. So, I mean, I keep telling her she should paint, because she just catches stuff, you know.
Yeah. Well, we've only got about 15 minutes left, so Blanche, I'm going to throw it to you and let you ask one final question of George.
George, let's see. Well, this is about beauty everywhere and how it relates to our own mortality. There's so much beauty around us, some we don't even see because we see it every day. And you've got so much going on in your life, every day, going in so many different directions. Are there things that make you slow down so you can see? How can we get in the mindset of seeing the beauty and feeling it, get in touch with our feelings?
That is a great question. I don't know if I really know the answer to it completely, other than, for me, you know, it's like anything in life. I think it's a muscle that you just exercise, and you get a kind of muscle memory. I'm kind of forever in that zone, you know. Now, I'm always just looking at stuff. I'm always, I guess it's like some kind of meditation, you know. You know, sometimes I get pretty caught up in my day-to-day stuff, but I manage to take the time to get out of my own way, in a way, get out of my own space, because when you're in that moment of looking outside yourself, you know, and seeing something just that you personally happen to find beautiful and moving, it invigorates you in a way again, you know, and you get out of the self, you get out of your own mind space or whatever. I don't even know what words I'm looking for exactly, but, and you let something bigger than you inside, and that's the space I try to create from, you know. I mean, like right now, the room that I'm in Los Angeles. It's a beautiful day. I'm in the hills. It's breezy, and I got the windows open, and there's light dancing all over the place, and shadows, and it's, you know, and I hear the wind rushing through the tree over next to my house. It's kind of a breezy day. I don't know. I mean, I try to keep my soul in that spot all the time, because I just love being in that space. You know, I mean, if I had to think of some of my favorite sounds in the world, there's, I'm sure you've been in the mountains when the wind starts to rustle through the pines. It's just this endless whisper, you know. And the same thing like with when a creek is trickling over rocks. I can't think of better sounds. Or like, or when the wood fills up with snow, you know. Those things are like, they're I don't know how to describe them. They're so much bigger than you, and they're so much more wonderful than you, and they're so much more important than you. You know, and yeah, and nature will be doing this and long after we're gone, you know. And I think to somehow be a part of it for that special moment is just like a real gift. And it's sad to me how it gets poo-bahed, you know, by certain individuals as being lightweight I don't know, frivolous, or, you know, it's the exact opposite. I mean, you're really not getting what life is about if you can't appreciate those wonderful, simple things, you know, that are the most spectacular, you know. And I really mean that with all my heart. I mean, there's no better drug in the world than that, you know. I mean, that's than fresh air in God's country. You know, I can't think of anything more spectacular. And I've tried my share of substances over the years, you know, and they didn't work, you know. I mean,
wasn't as good.
Yeah, not nearly as good as this.
Yeah, I guess you just have to make yourself slow down and see all that beauty that's around us all the time.
You have to try. I mean, it's there. It's there all the time. You know, it's right in front of us. We just have to see it. You know, take the time to see it. I mean, you know, I see it sometimes. You know, as corny as this sounds, like, I have friends that hang around with me when I'm working, and I'll see like a twinkle in their eye or something. You know, like I'm painting a painting, and a friend of mine sitting behind me. I have this friend Nathan. He's always sitting behind me wearing this hat, and he's got a cigarette in his mouth or something, you know, and I'll turn around and look at him, and he looks like a child almost to me, you know. He's got like a twinkle, and I go, hey, sit still, I'm going to try to paint this moment, you know. I mean, you just got to stay open to it, you know. It's all there. It's just going around us all the time. It's in front of us all the time, you know.
Great. But I think that's probably a great place to bring our discussion to a close. George, we've got about 10 minutes left.
Okay.
Is there anything that you'd like to say that, you know, what do you have coming up after Weekend with the Masters?
I have, in terms of the art stuff, I'm at a show I guess Steve Wynn is doing this this big show in Las Vegas, which I believe is the third week of December, and I've been invited to go to it, and I'm going with Tony Pro and Alexi Steele, and we'll be hawking our wares at the at the art show. It's a big representational art show, and I believe there'll be some modern art there too. But it was really cool. I don't know how many paintings I'm going to have there. I'm going to lug as many as I can. I'll probably bring like 20 pieces. That I got a lot of big paintings, so. I'll be at that. And in terms of movie stuff, I'm just always doing something. But you know, I at some point I want to put together a book of my work. I've been painting a lot of images as of late, of things that are like these memories that I haven't been able to let go of. Things that I've seen that flashed before my eyes and then were gone. I mean, like many years ago, I was coming back from a painting trip with Rulon Hacking, who was just a wonderful artist. Man, it was wintertime, and we were driving through Taos, and there was snow all over the ground. It was late in the day, and big storm clouds, you know, like brewing in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, you know, and the light was just slamming into these adobes, you know, this orange light. And as we were going over this little bridge, over this creek, I looked to my right because he was driving and I was on the right side of the, I looked to my right and in the snow there was a little makeshift cemetery, and there was a man standing there with his head down, with such regret in his body, looking at this one cross. And I was like, oh my God. I mean, it was just this bizarrely beautiful, tragic image. And I looked to Rulon. I said, did you see that? I said, man, I said, you know, that's a painting. If I could just remember that. And that's 20 years ago. And I just did it. I just finished it. I never got around to doing it. And I've been doing stuff like that lately. Another image, I remember years ago I was driving up to Seattle and in Oregon I was on the side of the road. I looked across the field, it was with my wife and a friend of mine, and there was a woman hanging clothes in the wind, and this really, really, really broken down farm. These people really had no money, you could tell them. There's all this rusted farm equipment in the foreground, you know, and they had this big American flag flying over their house. And I was like, wow. I'm like, and those guys are patriots. I mean, they clearly don't have anything, and they've got this big flag flying over their house. And then who knows, like maybe their son is in the Army or something, you know, or daughter is in the Army. And I always remember that. I painted that recently, you know, and I've just been trying to, and I've got about, I'd say two dozen of those things that I've saw, that things that I've seen that I just never stop thinking about, you know. So I think it's about time I get some of these images down, you know, on camera. Yeah. So that's what I've been doing.
That's a bit different from you.
I'm sorry?
That's a bit different than what you've been doing.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, because I've been doing a lot of landscapes outside, and I do paintings of my friends that I really don't show to anybody. And generally, I give them away as presents, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, but, you know, to include the figures and all of this stuff is kind of a new thing, you know, but it's something I just kept saying I was going to do, and I finally, you know, I forgot the first one I did where I did all the figures. The first one I did was of these, I did a bunch of migrant workers that were working in Simi Valley on a very, very, very windy day, and I was just really, in California, the enormous clouds in the sky, and there was still snow in the mountains in the distance, and I was just watching all of these workers. They were all bundled up with their hoods and their caps and their gloves, and I mean, this is backbreaking work. I was just watching them all, but there was I don't know, I mean, as an observer, there was something I'm sure it's a quite horrendous way to make a living, but there was also something, I don't know, beautiful about the simplicity of it in a way, you know. So I sketched a bunch of images. I sketched a bunch of their shapes, and then I painted the landscape pretty much from memory. And I showed it to David LaFell, and he thought, he said, George, he said, do you know David LaFell? Are you going to interview him?
We're unfortunately not going to be able to interview David.
Oh, he's great. He's great. He's George, George. He's got this New York accent. George, he said, he said, stick with these. This is a good way to go. So, you know, he knows a thing or two. So that's what I've been doing. You know? Yeah.
All right. Well, I can say without a doubt that I'm looking very, very forward to meeting you in person out in San Diego.
Me too. I'm looking forward to meeting you guys. I hope I was even mildly informative and entertaining.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, George.
Thank you, guys. You made it very, very pleasant. I was a little nervous about this, to be honest with you. So I didn't know if I would talk too much or talk too little. But I hope I was a help to anyone listening.
Oh, thank you. We enjoyed every minute of it.
Okay.
Well, yes, we did. And I just want to remind the listeners that are still out there that our next show is with CW Mundi. It'll be on June 12th. At 7 o'clock Eastern Time is the start of that. And please forward the link to the show to all your friends and tell them, you know, what a great interview this was with George. And we're going to say goodnight at this point, and we'll see you next week. Thank you again, George.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night,
bye.
Everyone. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
I think I was good. Yeah, I had a plan. You know me, I get started on this subject, I can't shut up.